I'd love to wish you all a happy Labor Day, but for this to be a happy Labor Day and really include issues of labor would be hypocrisy, denial of the reality that labor is in terrible condition in this country and in terrible condition around the world. In this political season, a season of exaggeration at best and hypocrisy at normal, we always honor the working man and try to remember the working woman, although it's best if you all stay home and raise at least 5 children, as long as you're raising white children, but that's a whole nother story. That's a whole different kind of labor in both senses, I suppose. The truth is that we have a very ambivalent attitude towards labor. We praise it. We sing of the qualities of the American worker as if we were a different genome from workers in the rest of the world. And we talk about the great dignity of work. And we don't really mean it. And we need to look at this kind of clear-eyed about what our attitudes are towards work and what the tensions around our attitudes are around work. We don't have very much respect for people who work with their hands. We have more respect for people who work with their minds, although hands and minds occasionally get put together in a lot of our work, but we kind of bifurcate this work. And working is just fine, but we wouldn't want our sons or daughters to marry a real worker. Our union movement in this country has shrunk from nearly 34% of the workforce to under 10% of the workforce, and most of that has been a growth in public union membership and a diminishment on what we used to call working unions, the people who build things, the people who build our cars, the people who mill the steel, the people who mine the coal. Those are the workers, and those unions are very, very diminished. They have not been diminished because we have achieved some idealized workers' paradise. All of the issues of the 19th century are still issues today. Work being undercompensated, benefits being inappropriate, safety conditions, on the books, our safety conditions for workers are much better. But if you actually had people to enforce those regulations, it would be a different story. But we don't. And so after every mine disaster, after every oil spill or explosion, we investigate. But the truth is we don't put the money and the effort into actually having those conditions that are mandated. And so the workers are out there at their own risks and serving at our pleasure. And we don't want to pay. We don't want to pay living wages. And I'm not bagging on you. I'm talking about in general. We look at the people who plant our crops, who harvest our crops, who bring the food by truck into our city, who prepare the food, who serve the food, who clean up after the food, and after we have either bought it or eaten it in a restaurant. And the day when the people who did these things, the people who built for us, could on one salary buy a home, raise a family, and educate a family are gone. And the union movement has been shriveled by offshoring, by union busting, by telling workers, and in this I'm going to include teachers, that you're going to lose your jobs if you don't give back some of the hard-earned benefits that you negotiated over the years with blood, with sweat, with tears, and with goodwill. That some of the benefits seemed large and that the legacy costs to some corporations are enormous involve a couple of things. One of them, the classic societal bubble, which is when things are expanding, we figure they will never contract, and so there are fundings that are mandated. But there were huge amounts and are huge amounts in both public unions and private unions that are underfunded, that the corporations did not do their job and the government did not do their job in actually funding the benefits because they thought that growth would fund those benefits. There are some that are completely unfunded, and now cities and states and corporations find themselves unable to keep the promises that they made to workers. What this means, aside from being unfair at so many levels, is that smart people who negotiate wage packages in the future will not trust the promises of deferred compensation and will demand more money up front, because promises about later are apparently too easily broken if companies and if cities and maybe even states can go into bankruptcy and get rid of all of that accrued, what they're calling debt, that were really commitments that were made. Yes, there's lots of stuff that needs to be fixed. Double dipping on pensions and the amount of pensions that are given, and costs need to be controlled on medical care. And yes, it is true that a lot of these systems planned on people dying within 18 months of retirement and not living for another 15 and 20 years. There have to be adjustments that are done with respect, but when we are told that it's the piggy unions that have done all of this, and Wisconsin has been brought to its knees by teachers' pensions, we're dealing with a whole alternate, fantastical universe that has very little bearing on reality. It's so interesting and disheartening to me that when you get into salary negotiations, unions and bosses, that you find a couple of things. You must give things back or we will have to lay you off. You must give things back or the factory will close and we will send our factory overseas and keep our profits overseas. You have to give things back or classroom teachers, and you know who you are, will receive pink slips warning you that you may be laid off until they magically find something under the pillows and under the couches. But it's not treating workers, from those who work with their hands to those who work in our classrooms, with respect and recognizing there are inherent dignity. Because that's not how you treat people with dignity. Every year tell them, oh, you may be gone, just hang on and we'll see. Teachers, many of whom are human beings, tend to get a little upset when treated this way and leave the profession. They tend to get a little upset when they are told to teach to a test and not to teach to actually teach thinking skills, when they are punished for taking on the difficult classes in the difficult schools and trying to teach across this extraordinary, extraordinarily complex society we live in, with 30, 40, 50 different languages and all kinds of different socioeconomic groups, and then they are held to blame for whatever goes wrong. Workers, however we understand that, and we are all workers in one way or another, are only honored in this country with words and with a holiday, which, of course, the irony of honoring Labor Day as a day that we don't labor is something that you can deal with at another time. When we look at our attitudes towards work, they're distinctly ambivalent. And it's not just about, there's one exception to the, we don't really honor people who work by the sweat of their brows. And that one exception is sports. So that if you earn your money knocking other people senseless, or being knocked senseless yourselves, or running around a field and kicking a soccer ball, or playing tennis or baseball or golf, you will be well compensated for the hard work of playing children's games. But if you are planting and harvesting, if you are digging the coal, if you are extracting the oil, if you are working in the factories or in the school factories, then you're just a cog. And we really don't particularly honor you on Labor Day. It just isn't true. It's not just about the money. And it's about more than that. And I'm not just bagging on the United States of America, because this is true the world over. We have not achieved the workers' paradise here, nor did they ever achieve it in the Soviet Union or in China. If you wanted to get sent to a gulag or re-education camp, all you had to do in the Soviet Union or China was try to form a union or raise your hand and say, these working conditions seem to be unfair. They honored, again, the workers with words and with theories and with songs, but without decent working conditions or the rights to organize, to negotiate health and safety conditions, no less to negotiate issues of salary. That was completely off the table. And that's true the world over. But it's not simply a question of money. It's a question of different classes. I remember going to a wedding. Okay, I performed the wedding. And there were two groups marrying each, well, there were two groups representing the groups, it wasn't a group marriage. There were two groups standing in the wedding hall, and they had nothing to do with each other. They were from different planets. One college educated, mostly teachers. The other, some with some college, but they were union people, long-distance truck drivers, car repair people, plumbers, and factory workers who at that time were making much more money than the teachers. The class distinction was really interesting because these people had very little in common. And they looked at each other across this great divide, and I will tell you that the Chardonnays and the beers did not communicate well with each other. And the kids who got married talked about it with some sense of perceptive irony as, well, we've got two groups here, the slobs and the snobs. And the answer to your question is no, the marriage did not last. It did outlive the reception. I've had two that didn't, so, you know, let's at least... That wasn't the main problem. But our issues around work, it was interesting to watch these people. They were all being, in some ways, exploited. They were being rewarded in different kinds of ways. But there were class and educational distinctions that kept people apart. That is the tragedy of labor. We are pitted against each other by class and by conditions. We are pitted against each other because if teachers and factory workers ever got together, there might be something powerful. If people could find a way to deal with those 19th and early 20th century issues that still exist in the 21st century, they're the same issues. Respect for the work. Respect for the workers. Respect and acknowledgement of the inherent worth and dignity of everyone. I'm about to go into a closing paragraph that has Aristotle, Charles Dickens, and Ecclesiastes in it. I feel some confidence that nowhere else in this country are these three meeting in a paragraph in a sermon today. But Aristotle said that work was about what we put into the work and whether the artist worked in wood or in clay or in brass or in gold. The art came from the soul and the hands of the artist. The work that we do at any level, whatever we build, whether we build with a hammer or whether we create and save life with a pipette or a scalpel, the work and the art is in the will, in the soul, and in the hands. That's what creates the value and what creates the meaning. Not simply the amount of money, not simply the recognition of the entire world, but whether we can do things that are creative and meaningful to us. For so much of America, work is defined as exchanging our time for money, as opposed to using our time for creative purposes and social purposes. Dickens, in A Christmas Carol, had Marley say to Scrooge, "The business of life is mankind. It isn't simply in earning and acquiring. It is in doing things that are decent," which I would translate as seeing the inherent worth and dignity in all the different kinds of labor and treating people appropriately. In Ecclesiastes, it says that life is short and death is long, and that acquiring things, power, even transitory pleasure, is not the way of wisdom. The way of wisdom is to do what it is given to you to do with enthusiasm, being captured in that. And the word enthusiasm, incidentally, is an interesting one from the Greek, entheos. It means with a sense of bringing out and feeling the divine, however we understand or experience that. To find people we care about and to share our bread and our wine, Ecclesiastes is the source of the line, eat, drink, and be merry. So eat, drink, and be merry. Find people to share your food, your drink, and your merriment with. Find the worth and the dignity in the labor that you do and see it in the labor that all of those people who plant our crops, who harvest them, who bring them to market, who prepare them, who clean them, the people who mine and extract our energy, the people who teach our children, who take care of our children, who sew our clothes, whether here or abroad, that their inherent worth and dignity is treated not simply by words, but by real attitudes and by policies that recognize that, again, as the poet said, Dickens, that they are not different creatures bound on different journeys, but they are, pardon the expression, fellow travelers with us in this life. This life where labor and sweat are pulled apart from intellect. But we are the same beings with the same needs, due the same respect. So honor labor. Think about it. At least once a year. At least once a year, it's more than a white sale. It's more than sporting events. It's more than just a three-day holiday. It is a reminder of our interdependence. I hate to give you a setup line like this, but our lives, we didn't do it ourselves. We had parents. We had teachers. We had people who were here before who built this building. We had people who created this congregation. We had people who built the roads to it. We had people who taught us. We have people, endless, unnamed to us people, who make our lives possible. Labor Day is a reminder of the interdependent web, not simply out there of all existence, but the interdependent web in which we live, to which we contribute, that we spin part of that web with every choice that we make in our lives. And being present, being conscious, being grateful for life and our opportunity in this web is what Labor Day at its best reminds us to be.